Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with all of our most recent work or podcasts. I don't know if this is really work. This is us Skyping for an hour a week.
Our most recent pieces. Yeah. Our oeuvre.
We're real auteurs in the podcast. We most recently talked about Blade Runner 2049 and a double podcast of Dazed and Confused, Everybody Wants Some. Before that was American Vandal. And I also recently wrote something about Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris and Mike White. Their most recent films, Battle of the Sexes and Brad Status. Brad Status is maybe the worst title of a movie ever, but it's a good movie. Anyway, themacguffinman.com. Theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
What are we talking about today?
We're done getting sidetracked. It happened twice before the theme song. But now we're locked in. We are talking about Poltergeist.
Yes.
Whose idea was this? Is this mine or yours?
I the most recent time it was brought up, it was my idea, but I can very easily imagine you having mentioned this at some point.
Yeah,
let's not take credit. Let's just share the credit.
Okay. Yeah, let's Toby Hooper and Steven
today.
Spielberg. I'm not a take charge kind of guy, so. So we're talking about Poltergeist, which was an important horror movie, 1982. Horror sci-fi kind of haunted house movie that was a big hit, and this is when Spielberg's still kind of on the come up. I mean, this is the same year as E.T. Close Encounters is already out there, and as I kind of mentioned about that Toby Hooper Steven Spielberg joke, this movie is credited to be directed by Toby Hooper with producer credits and part of the writing credits for Steven Spielberg, but there is much controversy over the true nature of who directed this film, but there's definitely tons of Spielberg elements all over it. But it is credited to Toby Hooper, and he certainly claims that he did a lot of work on this, but I think it's just worth noting.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I'm sure we will talk about it more than that. I do feel it necessary to point out that Spielberg by this point is not. We're in a post-Raiders world. He is no longer on the come up, you know? He had put out Jaws, Close Encounters, and Raiders by this point. So I feel like Raiders is what, like, solidifies him as Spielberg, and then E.T. is just furthering that, you know?
Okay, yeah.
That's how I view it.
No, that's fair. Yeah, he's definitely not, like, yeah, an up-and-comer. So, yeah, on the come up is definitely
on his
not
third the... Sundance, although I guess Sundance didn't exist in 1982.
No, that's true. I mean, E.T. is just very big, but yes, Jaws and Raiders clearly also very huge in slightly different ways.
Yeah, and I mean, that is also part of my anti-E.T. bias that I sort of just imagine in my head that when people are like, what's a Steven Spielberg movie? I'd like to think the Family Feud survey would say number one answer is Raiders of the Lost Ark, but who knows? Yeah.
We'll ask Steve Harvey next time he's on.
Let's not Steve Harvey.
But Toby Hooper is most well known for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which he made on a pretty cheap budget, I think mm-hmm. 6 years before this, around there. And kind of never... I mean, so as I said, this one's kind of got a bit of controversy over who to credit with directing it, and he kind of never achieved a greater picture than Texas Chainsaw Massacre or this one, depending on how you want to cut it, right?
Yeah, but I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a it's almost like the Easy Rider of horror movies sort of thing. It's where and I mean, Night of the Living Dead, the George Romero movie, rightfully gets a lot of credit for that too, but it's sort of the same sort of thing where it was a shoestring budget horror movie that really caught the eye of culture and sort of just became more than more than one would anticipate given the budget. But yeah, you are correct that, I mean, we were talking about what the first movie people would think of for Steven Spielberg is. Like, that's a debate, just like this is a debate. But I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Poltergeist are the only two answers. You know?
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. And one more thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre that I think you kind of touched on, but I'll just spell it out a bit more about what that movie was for people. You'll hear Quentin Tarantino, you'll hear other directors talk about it, especially in horror. It was one of those, oh, you can do this movies. Mm-hmm. Like, you can put this on film and you can release this and it can make money. It's just because of the level of gore and some of the elements, other elements of it, it was just kind of, you know, the first of its kind and kind of took a lot of people aback and pushed the boundaries of what people thought you could make as a, well, make and release it all, let alone as a commercially viable project.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you could lump the first Mad Max in there as well, like the same sort of thing. And I mean, it's also the same time period.
So. Yeah. And so I saw this movie, I mean, probably about 20 years ago. Too young to probably see this movie. And I hadn't seen it since then, but it's just one, as we said, it's one of those ones that is important to the genre and to kind of cinema as a whole. And so I wanted to revisit it again, kind of knowing more of what resulted from it and just being able to watch it as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's I saw it like at a sleepover when I was like 7 and hadn't seen it since.
Okay. And so how'd you like it?
I thought it was quite captivating. It's a very entertaining movie. I'm not going to say it's perfect, but I will say it kind of felt like E.T. without all the shit I hate about E.T. So so I really enjoyed it. And it sort of helped me understand maybe what people like about E.T., you know, where they do, whereas this is the version where the children are actually in peril, like actual peril. And so that makes it more entertaining to me for some reason, I guess.
Yeah.
As opposed to being threatened with walkie-talkies.
Yeah. And from the Spielberg angle, I mean, I think you could look at E.T. and Close Encounters and this as different ways to approach kind of a similar story. You know, it's ghost versus aliens, and you know, there's a lot of differences about the movies, but this is heavier than E.T. You know, this is just, it's so much grosser and with an element of danger. I mean, the bird is the only thing that dies in this movie, but between melting faces and
faces being peeled off.
Yeah, it's pretty unpleasant. And there is that element of danger in those other two movies. But this one, you know, the notion that your child's gone and may never come back, and some of the violence and some of the jumps in this one, just it's just heavier and more adult than those other two. Well, I guess Close Encounters is pretty adult, but not unpleasantly so.
Yeah, yeah. Close Encounters is a much more gentle movie than this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's very entertaining. And I knew a little bit about the Steven Spielberg director controversy, obviously, because it might be the most famous thing about this movie. or I guess not the most famous thing, but to people like us, probably is. I found it very interesting to watch from that perspective, especially since the movie starts off with a shot that was 100% directed by Steven Spielberg, and I refuse to believe anything to the contrary.
What's the opening shot?
It's when, like, it's the really close-up of the TV. The camera sort of, it does that Tony Zhao in his Every Frame of Painting video from a handful of years ago refers to as the Spielberg one-er, where the camera starts as one shot and then either, you know, tilts or pans or dollies back in this case, and you sort of get, then you get another setup where the dog walks in front of the camera and the camera sort of follows the dog a little bit, you know, and so you get like three shots within one without an edit. And that's the Spielberg specialty. There aren't a ton of examples of that in this movie, but that one, as somebody that came into this movie ready and willing to give Toby Hooper credit, like the first shot really absolutely screamed good good luck, Alex, you know. It was quite good. And Craig T. Nelson is always fun.
Yeah. He is fine. I just don't know what else I know him. Like, I know he's Coach, but I don't know what else I've actually got to enjoy his
he's
work.
He's no
in.
Longer Coach. Kyle Chandler took Coach from him. He's, okay. He's Mr. Incredible now.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Just there's just some sort of he has a pleasant presence about him, I think.
Yeah, he seems real and funny in this. And it is a movie that centers around a family, and that's one of the other Spielberg things about it. Not that he's the only one that can make movies about families, but it's just something that's been very important to his career, especially early on. Mm-hmm. And I think I think everyone's good in it, I think that's important to this, because yeah, I think Craig T. Nelson is fun to watch do his thing, and the kids are fine, and the mother's good, and the characters that join the cast later to clean the house are also very fun to watch do their job.
Yeah, for sure. I actually think Carol Ann is the youngest, right?
Yeah,
I think she's terrible in this movie, and I know she's a small child, but like, I just don't find her performance good at all. I don't know. That's something that really stuck out to me.
Okay.
Yeah, and also, like, she is a small child, was a small child, So
yes.
But I don't know. It's not just every scene she was in really stuck out at the beginning, before she gets disappeared.
Yeah, luckily they take her away for you. So. Mm-hmm. And did you find the Spielberg kind of family element to be here in the typical way of what he did around that time in his career? Or
oh yeah, for sure, because it has that, like, I don't understand why films of the 80s and films trying to replicate, or films and TV shows trying to replicate the 80s, always do this. But it's like, whenever there's a scene with a family, it, like, they're all in one room and literally every single person is being as loud as they possibly can at one time, and it drives me bonkers. Maybe I just had a different experience. Maybe I'm just, I mean, I am from a more quiet family than the average, but it's like, it's 8 a.m, you're eating waffles, you're fucking tired, why are you the loudest person in the world? Like, I remember being that age and eating waffles at the breakfast table, and I wasn't also screaming and throwing shit at a TV, Like, it just drives me crazy. And, I mean, it's present in E.T., Close Encounters, and as such, it has been replicated by all of the Spielberg thievery that we've seen in Super 8 especially, and stuff like Stranger Things, where the kids are just like constantly as loud as humanly possible, and so are the parents, and the parents are both talking and nobody's listening to anybody, and that just drives me crazy. That might be the most horrifying part of this movie to me. It makes me very uncomfortable.
Do you think there's anything like thematic to that, or is that just Spielberg did it and then people think that that's how the 80s look on film?
I think it's supposed to be like, if I am to try and give it as much credit as I can, you can really see the beginning of a very cluttered culture starting in the 1980s, where again, just, I mean, we talked about this with Capote probably a couple months ago, how there's a book reading that sells out a theater in that movie. And the reason that's able to happen in the 60s with Capote is because there were just fewer options for entertainment. So reading mattered more, right? 1982, you've got just more television options, and cinema has sort of, like, the big blockbuster cinema has started because Steven Spielberg made it happen. And I just sort of think it's this continually growing number of options. And I don't know, just the growth of culture makes it sort of a busier breakfast table. And I don't know, just that's me trying to film school it, and give this movie some credit. But mostly it just drives me bananas.
Yeah, and so television is, like, so central to this movie, so yes. I knew we'd get to it. And so just because you've brought up this idea of the cultural timeline, is there something about television in the 80s, or is there something about the 80s that makes, like, if this horror movie takes place 10 years before, is the TV not a part of it, or is the TV much less central, or... what's the change that makes the TV because like it's on the poster. It's sets everything in motion. The closing shot has to do with television.
Yeah.
There's just no way around it. Is there something that happens that makes this so important?
I think what it is, because I can't think of an event that raises the import of the television itself, like in the home. But also, I was born 4 years after this movie came out, too. So, like, we're not really the right cultural spelunkers for this question. But because in the 90s, when cable starts to become popularized, that would be something that would elevate television in the culture. But I think the thing that I see it as is Spielberg's generation is the first generation of filmmakers that grew up as they were children as TV started to become something that would be in the home, sort of like we were children as the internet started to become something that was in the home. And so they are the first generation of people that view television as something that has always been a part of their life. So I think they just sort of view television as more important because they've always sort of had it. Whereas an older filmmaker may or may not have thought about how much television actually gets watched by a generation younger than them. And now that the generation younger, the Spielberg generation, was actually making films, the level of import of the television just sort of trickled into movies.
Yeah.
I think that's down. More because, like, you know, Spielberg's probably about 30 at the time of this movie. TV starts to become popularized in the 1950s. You know, the timeline just checks out.
Yeah. And yeah, because I was looking for something like cable, you know, like something where we can say this is why this is big now. And that's the thing that you brought up. Mm-hmm. But with this idea that he's someone who grew up with it, the paranormal force, whatever it is, the beast, however you want to define it in this movie, is such an intruder, right? And that's why I think that someone maybe who grew up and adjusted to life without television, or like he kind of grew up without television then adjusted to life with it, would be more likely to depict it in this way, you know, as something that wasn't there and then suddenly was. Mm-hmm. You know, that level of intrusion that changes the family dynamic. And there isn't that thing like cable or something I can point to. But even without that, there's just the increased importance of it in culture. You know, it's TV, you know, the signal used to die, right? Like there wasn't something you could watch if you're up at 3 a.m. They would stop airing things. And there's always just been more channels and there's always been more coverage. And there's always just been this idea that as it got bigger and bigger, it just played a more important part in everybody's life and a more central part of it. So I don't think that there is that thing we can point to, but I think that maybe this movie just kind of checks in at a time. I mean, even if it's this gradual continuation of how important it is, it checks in at a time that there is some blurry line that it has crossed. And maybe it's just the idea of these kids are young and they've lived their whole life with it and it's very important to them.
I think that's a big part of it. I think I was talking more about television in film generally. Okay. My take on television in this film specifically is that so much of this movie is about learning that things, human-made things that are meant to be, help build a community or help foster the idea of a community, of being closer to other people, demonize is a cheap way to say it, but kind of demonize, like, because the way that the suburb, that Cuesta Verde, is that where the name of the place?
Yes.
That community that they live in, it's this new suburban community, and when you think of suburbs, it's like, oh, it's this nice community where people get along and everything. But the family's so isolated. The Freelings are so isolated. They hate their next door neighbors. And I think TV is another version of the suburbs, where it's something that makes you feel like you are closer in a community. Like you can watch something on TV that makes you feel like you're in Washington when Ronald Reagan's speaking or whatever. But it is just this. It's this false sense of community that the television gives you. And I think the Freelings, throughout the movie, the idea is that they just feel more and more alone as the movie goes on. And you start to realize that the only thing that they really have is their very small family unit, because that's all any family can really hope to have. And I think that them removing the television in the last shot of the movie, while all having just left the suburbs for a smaller version of a community in a hotel, but one that's sort of explicit about its capitalistic desires, is them just sort of being like, this is a thing that lies to us about being a community. We want it outside of the room that holds my family, holds our family, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it does make sense. And yeah, there is this negative light to it that's just undeniable.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It's put in this. In many different ways, we see it as this negative thing. And just to go to the start of the film, and one of the things we talked about near the beginning of this podcast, it's that close-up of the television with the national anthem playing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's so close, sure, is indistinct. You know, you're not even sure what you're looking at. It's so maybe pixelated. It's not the right word for a television of that time period. But
pixels didn't exist yet. You're right.
But, yeah. You know, it's too close. And so you have this, there's something that's so, you know, you speak about community. There's something that's so familiar and communal about the national anthem. You know, you listen to it in school or before a football game and in crowds. And it's literally, you know, this song for your country, the song that is to bring the whole group together. But the closeness to it, you know, you're looking so closely at it that you see the flaws of it. That this thing at a distance might seem fine and might seem like something that, as you said, can bring everybody together. But, you know, when you get to the nitty gritty of it, there's this unpleasantness and there's this darkness to it. And that's kind of what sets the tone for this whole movie. And I think we're agreeing about this depiction of it as something that is meant to bring people together, but really separates people. And, you know, we have, you know, Craig T. Nelson and his friends watching football. You know, they have their little close-knit group, but then they cross signals with their neighbor and it quickly becomes, you know, a conflict. Yeah. And there's a community in one house and there's a community in the other, and they're watching this thing that is meant to bring people together, or at least sold as something that could, and it just becomes this problem. Now, in their defense, if I was watching football or if I was watching anything and I had a TV that changed channels because of the remote of my neighbors, that's obviously something that's extremely frustrating. But just this depiction of these two houses living so close together and that proximity not leading to a harmonious relationship, and quite the opposite, in fact.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And also you can sort of see this visually throughout the movie. So the very beginning, at the very beginning of this movie, like the opening scene, like it doesn't really, what I'm about to describe doesn't really feel like it's present, but as the movie starts to go on, you start to see it. And what they seemed to do was use really, really wide lenses. And I think the set of the house was really large and just sort of like staged in a way to make these rooms feel like they're getting bigger. So, because a lot of the images in this, I mean, it's shot anamorphic and a lot of the images are like really distorted, which means they use pretty wide angle anamorphic lenses. And what that does is sort of increase the depth of field that you've got. And it also, like in this movie, they staged it in a way that makes people in the background look way further than they probably actually are. And I think that that's really key in because you're seeing separation between people, which is exactly what is happening with Carol Ann and the rest of her family.
Yeah.
And the whole movie is about closing that gap. And I think that's something that the television is sort of, again, like a sort of a false idea of that, like a false product of being able to do that. Just like the suburb doesn't necessarily make you closer with the people around you because you're in this community. And I think that that's the way that the movie communicates it visually. through choosing super wide lenses and just really interesting staging. Like, because there are some shots in this movie that just look incorrect. They're so distorted. And so it just sort of screams at you, like, we meant to do this. And sorry, I guess it doesn't scream at everybody. It screams at nerds.
Yeah, but I think it also manages to do that in a way that you might not be able to articulate, but one might not be able to articulate, but still kind of subtly gives that visual idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the one key visual idea that happens continually throughout the movie, and becomes when so much of the movie starts taking place in the living room after they go, what school are they from? Oh, whatever. Stanford. Okay, the people from the paranormal activity department at Stanford. Once they sort of start to come in and set up shop in the living room, like, that's when you really, really start to see it. And it just becomes so evident. Like, there are a couple shots of the staircase that are like, holy shit, this looks weird and awesome, and I love it. Yeah.
And at that point, we understand. I mean, we've already understood that something's going wrong and that Carolina is gone, but this is when they start articulating, you know, it's a different dimension and there's a portal in your, you know, in your closet, and that just really verbalizing exactly how distant in whatever way their daughter is at this point.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah, and I think that part of it is the I think that it's the over reliance on television as well. I think maybe as a parenting tool, I get this sense of guilt from this movie. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the overriding things about just the guilt of these parents maybe not being the best parents they can be, even though they don't seem like terrible parents. You know, they seem pretty attentive for the most part. They seem, you know, like fun and caring and all of that. But I think that I think there's the sense that they're doing what everybody else is doing and parenting the way that the culture wants them to or expects them to, but that's not healthy. You know, it's not that these people are particularly bad parents. It's that they're kind of functioning in a culture that might be neglecting them. And I think that, or like might have parents typically neglecting their children in exchange for the television functioning as a babysitter. And I think that we see that well when Carol Ann's watching TV really closely and it's just static, and you know, the mom says, "That's going to hurt your eyes." She changes it to this pretty violent war movie. Just this idea that something's better than nothing, and watching something on television, no matter what the content, is better than watching nothing at all. Because, you know, she says it's about her eyes, but I think it's just that there's this level of boredom that's going to kick in and cause her to do something else, and that we're putting trust in the television to entertain and raise the kids in a way that we haven't really let a form of media do in the past.
Yeah.
And that's what I see from that scene, just this idea that you know, she'll change the channel and see that something's on and that's enough, and it's so clearly not something that's appropriate for a child, let alone a pretty young child. But there's just a level of trust put in television that's unhealthy. Do you get that notion from that scene or anything else?
I think that is, yes, I can see that that you're explaining, now that you're explaining it. And I, again, it goes back to the what we were talking about previously, where you know, to talk specifically about the scene you described, the mother and daughter are in the kitchen together, and the television is sort of pushing them further apart, right? Because they're not really spending time together. They're physically together, but the television is taking Carol Ann to war instead, you know? Yeah. I can sort of see that. I do love the way this movie depicts parenting, though, or the parents specifically. There's something about it that feels very honest. It feels like...
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's going to come as no surprise to you that I'm a huge fan of the scene where the parents are smoking weed. I think that's like a really, really engaging scene. And like, it doesn't matter that it's weed. They could have just been having drinks or whatever, or just like being adults and trying to have a private moment in a time in their lives when that is so difficult, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool. And I like the way that both Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth. Her last name is Williams, right?
I think so.
Okay. Both sort of depict themselves as parents as like, because they feel like appropriately tired. And when, like, what I was talking about with like the loud breakfast table stuff, that drives me crazy with the kids because I think that's somebody like projecting onto kids and like trying too hard. But with the parents, like, them sort of like focusing on eight different things feels more real to me. And the way that Craig T. Nelson, when he's on the phone and he's like only kind of paying attention to anything that's happening with his family because he's very concerned about what's happening on the other end of this phone call, I find that stuff very, that is something that felt very cool and also felt like something that I still see very rarely, you know, where parents just, I don't know, it feels like parents are either portrayed in media as or in media where kids are main characters, it seems like parents are either portrayed as perfect or shitty, and the Freelings in this movie are just portrayed as adult people in their early 30s who happen to have children, you know. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's not, I think there's a lot of different ones where the parents are smoking weed and the girl drowns in the pool.
Yes,
right?
100%.
Like, just the idea that they're doing this illicit thing. And yeah, no, they play it, you know, in an extremely reasonable way. They're smoking weed. Their kid comes into the room. They put the joint out and they parent. Know what I mean? They just function as they should. And yeah, I think you're right that there's this false dichotomy of just absolute monsters or unbelievably good parents, and this is more straight down the middle in a very good way.
Yeah, exactly. And like you get tons of movies about people conflicted about, you know, whether or not they're a good parent or whatever. Like, I feel like every indie movie for a 6-year period from like 2008 to 2014 featured something along those lines. But those movies were all more like focused from the adult perspective. Whereas this, you know, you can take your pick for who you think the main character in this movie is, but it does, the kids and the parents are much closer together in that ranking than most other movies that address parenting, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to look at it as this Spielberg product, as someone who talks about family so much, because, you know, we see everybody's kinds of fear play out. You know, we have Joe Beth talking about, or I guess both the parents kind of expressing their concerns about what adults and parents, you know, seemingly should be or typically are concerned about. You know, maybe she's going to sleepwalk into the pool. And these sort of parental concerns that resonate in a very meaningful way. And then we also have what Spielberg has said were his childhood fears, you know, the tree outside his window and his fear of clowns, mm-hmm. were two things that he has said, you know, they're in this movie because that's what I was afraid of as a kid. There was this, there was a tree outside my window. Clowns freaked me out as a kid. Mm-hmm. And so it obviously makes sense with a family of people of different ages, but it does kind of play to everybody in that way, you know, just the fear of a child going missing, but also the fear of a clown or, you know, Robbie looking under his bed. It kind of services everybody's fears, and in that way, kind of, if you're an adult watching it with kids, you can kind of relate to that fear of, you know, you can't find your daughter and just how unpleasant that must be. But then also these more childish concerns come into play. And as someone who kind of talks about or who depicts these family situations a lot, it was interesting to see him address all these particular fears of people of different demographics.
Yes. Yeah. And as somebody who's, I think he has a child by now. So probably somebody who is pretty recently a parent and has parenting on the brain quite a bit, you know?
Yeah. And so he's, as you said, probably 30 around this time in early 80s.
I would guess. I'll look it up now. But as you talk.
Yeah. And so I touched on it a little bit before, but just this idea of,
he's 36 when this movie comes out.
Okay. So just this idea of, guilty parents. And as we said, I don't think that they depict these parents as terrible people who have a ton to be guilty about. But I think it just strikes me as this movie of parents unsure about if they're doing the right thing or if they're coming up short. And I think that part of it is this notion, as we find out, that where they're living is literally built on top of corpses, right? Mm-hmm. Like and another huge theme in this is just the idea of construction, you know, like building a family, building a house, putting the pool in, you know, it's the subdivision that's not complete. We later on and go see these tracks where these are where houses are going to be, but they're not there yet. And you know, the father is someone who works for this real estate developer, and you know, we see him even convincing someone to try to move their family there or raise a family in this area. And just the idea that it's literally on top of where people had died. And the weed smoking scene kind of hits me as a particularly timely one of the era, because, you know, we're coming out of the 60s and 70s when these people would have grown up. It's, you know, I know people smoked weed in the 80s of all ages, but it's still something that is tied to the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, the 80s is cocaine.
Yeah, 80s is coke and 90s is ecstasy.
actually, yeah, that's right. 90, I think it's more heroin and then a little bit of ecstasy.
And then the aughts is all whippets.
yeah, we're of a whippets generation, my friend.
We're peak whippet. Yeah. it's this idea that they're still kind of this holdover from that time, and they're raising their kids in this slightly different world. And you know, as I said, they're using television to kind of help raise the kids, and it's, you know, this layer on top of the last layer, and whether or not you're living up to the last generation, I think that's why this notion of, you know, finding the dead bodies in that come out of the swimming pool, and this notion of the suburb comes up again, and that this is like this picturesque suburban childhood, but you know, it's built right on top of maybe something that was a bit more pure that comes back, and they've mangled their memories a little bit to build these cookie cutter homes on top of you know, where people have been laid to rest. And I think that it's telling that Carol Ann's the one who's been taken, because, you know, she's the youngest. She's maybe not spoiled yet by living this time period for too long. And I think it's important that they say that she was born inside her home too, right? Like there's something very domestic and very pure to that. And obviously she's just like this sweet looking little cute young, you know, American looking kid. And yeah, just there's this idea of the constant construction of the neighborhood around them, and just building, you know, right on top of the generation that came before it, and you may be relying on television a bit too much, and the idea that this kid gets taken, and there's something that they have to do in order to get that back. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I can see that for sure. And also just sort of the idea of like having to care about what came before you paved your world in, you know, like, because in the case of a suburb, like, you know, the construction of a suburb is literally building on land that used to be used for something else entirely. And just this sort of responsibility that you have to feel for the earth. It's like the earth didn't come into existence on May 4th, 1986 when I was born, you know, like it existed before, and you have to sort of care a little bit about what came before you. Just like, you know, as it just to be a parent, you have to care about what came before you, because you have to realize that you want your kids to do the same, because you want your kids to value your memory after you're dead too. Right. And I think that sort of applies to a lot of elements of life. You know, it's just sort of like, think about what used to be here, you know, and sort of use that to put your own life in perspective, and to use it to sort of frame how you feel about various things in your life, you know?
Yeah. And then we talked about this scene earlier, but you know, it's all the grown-up men watching football, and then right next door there's someone watching Mr. Rogers. Yeah. And there's this, you know, they kind of butt heads over this. It's like, do we do this adult thing that we enjoy, or do we do this thing, or, you know, do we let someone else watch this, you know, sweet old man, you know, teach kids and be fun and useful and all that kind of stuff that Mr. Rogers represents. Like, and, you know, they get angry and they fight, and it's this idea that they're putting these somewhat adult pleasures over something that's useful for a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I get that. Well, you've brought up the football scene. I would like to talk about that very briefly, because yeah, that's another loud breakfast table situation that's sort of driving crazy. It's like they're all standing as physically close as possible to each other, and they're all yelling about the game and the beer and the game, like, just like so nonspecific. And I don't know, that one really grinded my gears too. But that again felt like a focus group describing what a bunch of people watching football looks like, as opposed to actually depicting what it looks like when people watch football.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have a section of notes as well of things that don't really tie into anything thematic that feel interesting to me, like seeing Gene Shalit on TV.
Always a welcome presence.
The idea of the real estate thing, I think, is an important theme too, but it also provides me with one of the shots that I really like, actually a few of the shots that I really like, and they tease it out a little bit, but it's when it's when the dad's boss takes him to the to the hill where he suggests his new home could be. And I think that's a really strong scene for a lot of reasons. I think one thing that we're going to get to is kind of place this a bit more in the 80s for what that was. You know, we see him tellingly reading a book about Reagan. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that some of the economics and some of the policies of that administration really do tie in with a lot of this. But just from a visual aspect to begin with, I love as we kind of follow them walking together, and we see this white picket fence, which is so emblematic of, you know, the good American suburban home.
Yeah, features prominently in Jaws as well.
Right, yeah, along the beach a lot. And it's, you know, we see the back of this fence. You know, we see it from inside what we eventually learn is a cemetery. And it's really not the focus of the scene. You know, we have two characters talking to each other, but the fence just isn't perfect. We're seeing the worst side of it, seemingly, and just pretty often a picket is out of place or leaning or just not that bright white picket fence that we picture when we think about that. And I think that's great. And I think that, you know, we kind of see the I guess it's the president of this company, with his values sort of misaligned. You know, the father of this family is kind of being coy about what's happened to his daughter at this point. You know, he's very concerned, that she might be in another dimension or being possessed by demons or something. But his boss only sees his concern as this power play for more money. You know, he kind of takes his reticence to be something about wanting to become a partner to move further in this company. And it just shows this very, this corporate, financially minded person, that the family is so secondary that the health or the concern of his children doesn't really come into play, and that he can only see things through the eyes of somebody who does everything they can to make more money. And then we get that shot of the cemetery on top of the hill, and the rest of the scene, or the rest of the frame being, you know, down the hill and to be the suburb that was built. And so I think it's only a few minutes, but I think it does this great job of showing kind of the dark underbelly of suburbia, showing something about the 1980s super corporate mindset. And the shots are really good, but I think that the way that they bring some of the themes into the fold. That's one of my favorite parts of this movie altogether.
Yeah, and I think something that helps augment what you're describing is that so little of this movie takes place outside of the Freelings' house or outside of the immediate vicinity of their house. And that is something where you actually get like a totally different view of the neighborhood. And so it just sort of feels like it has this, I mean, they're standing on top of a hill, so it's a bit vaunted anyway, but like this sort of vaunted presence in the movie, just because it sticks out so much just visually, because 80% of this movie happens inside of the Freelings' home, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And it just makes it a bit more dynamic. And that idea of, you know, the 80s, greed is good, Reaganomics, that this notion of the house on the hill, you know, mm-hmm. just to be up at this elevated position and to literally look down on the people, you know, the people that you've sold this product to. And as a result of that, you've become wealthy and now you can be in this literally elevated position and take a view on them. I think resonates with a lot of the themes.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the difference between being in the house and on the hill is that, like, as again, we talked about how this movie expands a close space to make the all the Freelings feel more alone, despite the fact that they're all in their own house. And yeah. That is a scene where you actually get to see an expansive environment. You know, like the set designer and the lens choices didn't have to do anything. It's just this big open space next to the suburbs. And it gives you a sense of scale that the movie otherwise has just not been giving you, because it wants you to feel like you're in a small space the whole time, and it just sort of feels big because of how alone you feel.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's still that element of claustrophobia. All their problems are within this house, but it's the separation between them that has caused this problem. I mean, at least if you want to go with some of the readings of allowing television to be this this force in your life that you've put too much faith in without really thinking it out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think that that scene also, we learn about the dad. We learn that he is a very good salesman. You know, he says he's responsible for 42% of the sales in this project. And that's when we start to see that, I don't know, that's at least for me when I start to think about how complicit he is in this, that if maybe he didn't ask enough questions about how they were able to do this, you know, he learns a little something about moving the headstones. And obviously it's not till the end that he learns that they moved the headstones, but they didn't move the bodies. But this idea of money over everything, you know, the sense that he might be complicit in this as someone who works for this company that does these things, that you allow a bit of consumerism into your life. And maybe now we can tie it into a bit more of the Reagan era economics, but just this idea that Ronald Reagan eased up on regulations and said that, you know, we'll make it easier for people to sell things. And there may be some negative externalities to that, but in the end, these companies are going to make more money and their employees are going to make more money. And, you know, famously, this idea of trickle-down economics, that if we get the people on top to make a ton of money, then everyone's going to be better off for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Spielberg / Tobe Hooper might be saying that.
I mean, Spielberg is a credited writer on this movie, so kind of.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fair then. Spielberg and Michael Graves and Mark Victor then.
Yeah. But I mean, the things that we're talking about jump out as so Spielbergian anyway.
True.
Yeah.
This idea that it's not going to work that way, that the guys on top are going to take these shortcuts and make a ton of money, you know, selling this land, selling these houses. But without the proper oversight, they're going to take these shortcuts. They're going to, you know, take the things on top, but not the things in the bottom. They're going to do the things that are visible, but not the things that actually matter. And that, it seems to me like the bodies and the ghosts are, you know, that unseen part of it, that thing that you can't predict, that let's make it easy for people to make money and hope for the best. And this is the downside. This is the thing that can't be predicted. This is the other half of the equation, that the little guy, that the family man, and, you know, the symbol of the helpless, you know, this cute little blonde, adorable daughter, the one who's helpless against making all these choices is the one who's going to suffer.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. It's trickle-down economics becomes trickle-down laziness, you know, and it's just like all of this, all of these things that, side effects that people don't see. But yes, I agree with what you're saying 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think
fuck rich people is what I'm saying.
Sure, let's go with that. Yeah.
I'll say it less eloquently.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything else that seems... I mean, we talked about 80s in this... in these television terms, do you see this era show up in a meaningful way?
I think it's just the way I just sort of really looked at the suburbs and how this movie portrays the suburbs as something that, especially at the time, still was still, well, I mean, again, this is me speaking about a time when I was not alive, but you sort of have this view of these communities as like very nice, safe spaces, you know, and just the idea that our perception of what suburbs are isn't necessarily correct, you know, and that they can cause harm. You know, it's like, I mean, all these houses look exactly the same. Just that sort of sameness that permeates through a community like this. I just sort of viewed it as a movie that embraced the fact that it came out in a decade when communities like this were popping up like crazy, and continued to happen all through the 90s. Like, I grew up in a city that was outside of a city, and our neighborhood was building up just like this, you know, and all of the houses looked the same. My next door neighbor's house looked exactly like mine, but flipped, you know, and all just all of these, this sameness and this just the way that it sort of makes the whole country feel like just this boring blob, right? And I think that sort of maybe ties into television, and in that we're all watching the same things, and so we're all going to be have our minds molded by the same things. But I don't know. I guess I'm just sort of rambling, and I don't really have a good answer. But I just sort of viewed like the way that it treats suburbs as just sort of like, don't view this necessarily as a very ideal place to be. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think with...
like, there are downsides to this cookie-cutter perfection.
Yeah, and within that kind of cookie-cutter thing, we see consumerism all over this. Mm-hmm. Like, the level of brands we see, the level of brands that are even discussed, you know, maybe it's a bit of an in-joke, the Wookiees and, like, the Star Wars stuff that we see, but...
Yeah, for sure. I think Spielberg's done that in other movies, too.
Oh, completely.
If you and I both made movies, we would 100% have references to the other movies.
Yeah, but just the idea that these things are, these products, these things that are meaningful, these things that have completely snuck into these private domestic spaces are these, you know, conglomerate products of these multi-billion-dollar corporations. And I think that's even part of, when I was talking about kids' horrors versus children's horrors, I think a very adult horror in this is the destruction of these goods, you know, like these appliances that malfunction and get destroyed, or the furniture that gets destroyed. It's this notion of someone who's worked for their whole life to accumulate these physical goods, and then to see them destroyed, mm-hmm. And to see their house destroyed, and to see, hand in hand with their children being taken and being scared. We also see that this, in a more material sense, that things are being damaged, and the idea that those are, you know, I'm not saying they're put on equal footing here, but that is the horror of someone who lives in the suburbs, you know, to see not only their child be taken or harmed or scared, but the material goods that they've accumulated in the meantime to be also made victims.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's talk a little bit about Spielberg's role as a producer, despite the, like, because we've just been talking about him like he directed the fucking movie for this whole conversation. But like,
I don't think we ever articulated the fact that a lot of this controversy comes from he was prepping E.T. at the time and had something in his contract saying that he couldn't work on anything else or couldn't direct anything else. So, the book kind of is that Toby Hooper directs this as Spielberg's workaround, even though he wanted to make a movie.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think also something that's important to point out is that this is the first movie that Steven Spielberg is credited as a producer on. Either like first one full stop or the first one that he's a producer that he also didn't direct, right? So, he's also like, even people that don't like his movies but understand cinema know that he is just like unbelievably talented as a filmmaker and as somebody that knows how to use the tools of filmmaking. We talked about the Spielberg Wonder briefly. Like, he's just, and especially at this time, he's like a genius, you know? And so you can kind of imagine a scenario where he signs on and he's like, I'm going to produce this movie. You know, I'll be hands off. I'll let the director do. I'll be the producer that I always want. I want somebody that will fight the battles that need to be fought and use their clout to sort of allow the director to be creative, you know, and just sort of focus on the movie, which is a producer's role typically. And then he sort of got to set and saw things that weren't happening in the way that he may have wanted them to be done, or things weren't happening quickly enough. And so he would just be like, just step in. And then what can Toby Hooper say, really? You know? And because he's Steven Spielberg, you know? And so I can see that sort of happening. And it's sort of, I think a good parallel is a lot of star athletes have a really hard time coaching. There's a lot of examples throughout history where really elite athletes are terrible coaches. And it's because if Michael Jordan ever coached a basketball team, it would just be an absolute nightmare. They'd win 2 games and lose 80 just because he would be constantly screaming at people and he'd be like, no, I could just do this myself. You know, like that's sort of the thing. And most star athletes who become coaches are physically unable to do what they used to be able to do, right? This is still
what Steven... I said about Peyton Manning when people are saying he'll just coach. I'm like, no chance. He could never understand why someone doesn't just do exactly what he does without being told.
So. Exactly. You can still see, like, even just watching footage of people like that on the sidelines talking to their players, like, why didn't you do this on this play? You can just see how that could never happen because they just can't even register, like, elite athletes can't even register why anybody would ever do anything wrong because they just it's just so foreign to them. And so, like, but going back to what I'm saying, like, retired athletes that coach, you know, they're physically unable to still play the game, but Steven Spielberg is still in his, like, Michael Jordan in 1996 phase, you know?
Yeah.
And he's still obviously the best at what he does, and pretty much everybody agrees on that. So naturally he's just going to step in and nobody's going to be like, hey, what's happening isn't okay. You know? So my feeling on this is that, Toby Hooper deserves more credit than he got. But I also think Spielberg deserves the amount of credit that he got, you know?
Yeah.
I think like the fairest credit would be a co-director credit.
Yeah, that seems more fair. And I think it's really telling that, when this controversy sort of arose around the time that it came out, Spielberg tried to defend it and said, Toby Hooper is just not a take charge kind of guy. So I'm paraphrasing here. The term take charge kind of guy is a direct quote, but the rest of this is more of a paraphrase. And he said, you know, so I would get on set and I would say something, I would suggest something, and Toby would kind of nod, and, you know, that would be our agreement. We'd work in that way. I think it's pretty safe to say that no director functioning at this level is not a take charge kind of guy or girl.
Like, it's the job description is taking charge.
Exactly. You just don't get to this point. You know, it's not grade 10 drama class where you take turns being the director. Like, this is you've done this because it's what you've wanted to do almost your whole life, and you want to be at this level, and you have a knack for it, clearly. So, but I think at the same time, the idea that Spielberg can describe someone as someone like Tobe Hooper as a not a take charge kind of guy, like, I think he's just looking at it as in comparison to him. And
yeah, oh, for sure.
That sounds reasonable to him. Like that sounds believable, that this director doesn't care at all because he doesn't care as much as I do. And that just didn't pass the smell test to anybody. Like, no one's just going with that as an explanation.
Yeah.
And, you know, in just reading reviews and people who, I mean, I've seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm not super familiar with a lot of Tobe Hooper's other work, but I don't think a lot of people are. There are shots and there are elements that people speak about in this that they say is clearly something Tobe Hooper would do. Just this idea that the way that he depicts chaos, an overturned bike, or the fact that their dead bird was upside down and not just on its side, you know, that sounds like small things, but people say that that's the way Tobe Hooper liked to do things, that you don't really get, first of all, the idea of chaos, he'll go 100% on, and that even after the fact that you never get that resolution. The idea that Tangina says that the house is clean and we still have a good 30 minutes of awfulness left mm-hmm. in this movie. That's more Hooper than Spielberg. Mm-hmm. Spielberg would like to put a bow on something, and Hooper would not. He'd like you to feel that things are secure even more than usual. You know, horror often has, you think the killer is dead, but then he comes back for one last scare. But this is more than that. This is someone, you know, the dad leaves and everything seems okay, and then five more absolutely awful things happen, mm-hmm. including, you know, the clown scene, which is one of the things people point to as being one of the most awful things in this movie. You still have that after the point that we should be in resolution mode, mm-hmm. that things are winding down. So that's a Tobe Hooper thing, is my understanding, to do that much after the point that you're supposed to start feeling comfortable. Mm-hmm. So I do think that his fingerprints are all over this thing, but yeah, I think you're right in saying that co-director is the way that this probably should have been broken down, because I think that they both deserve to be recognized for the vision of theirs that they placed on this, but mm-hmm. it's yeah, more contractual the way that it broke down than a true reflection of authorship.
Yeah, for sure. And also, just to follow up on your point about some of the more horrific things being very Tobe Hooper elements. I mean, if you look at Steven Spielberg's career as a director, there's no real movie that you can point to for those horror sequences that's like, oh yeah, for sure, this is how he would direct horror, because like, he just hasn't made a movie that's a straightaway horror like Poltergeist is, you know. So I think that's the real case for Tobe Hooper's work on this movie, is exactly what you described, and the fact that Steven Spielberg as a man who has been able to do basically whatever he has wanted to do for almost 40 years in Hollywood, yeah. has never made a horror movie in a fashion that Poltergeist was made in, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Although I guess the counter argument to that is because, well, he made Poltergeist, but, but this is the thing about fun Hollywood rumors, is that we'll never know. So yeah, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next time.